It's early 1967 at the Orlando office of a powerful Florida legislator, Senator Bob Elrod. Elrod is a busy man. Right now, he's sitting at a cluttered desk, staring across a mountain of paperwork at a neatly dressed lawyer with dark, slicked back hair, Disney rep and former World War II spy, Paul Helliwell.
People are concerned, Paul. I'm concerned. Rest assured, Senator, the plan hasn't changed. We're all broken up about Mr. Disney, but it's a fair question to ask, can there really be a Walt Disney World without Walt Disney?
Walt died a few weeks back. But for Paul Helliwell and the Project Future team, the work never stopped. Walt's brother Roy made sure of that. Roy sent Paul Helliwell to Orlando with a sole mission, to make sure the Florida legislators understand that Project Future is still a go.
Let me assure you, Roy has taken full control of the project. With all due respect, Roy's a fine man, but he's not his brother, and Roy knows that. He's sticking to Walt's plan, and he's instructed everyone at Disney to do their jobs just as Walt would have wanted, his exact words. Roy's given me his personal assurance. We're not canceling or postponing. We're moving forward.
Yeah, but with what exactly?
Listen, you know I support the project. Disney is good for Florida and my re-election prospects, but some of my colleagues are concerned. The legislative session starts in less than 2 months, and nobody's even seen a proposal from your camp. That's why I'm here, Senator. We need a sponsor to help us push the Disney bills through the legislature. Someone with experience to guide us through the process. Someone people respect.
Paul, don't butter me up. Of course I'll help you, but first you gotta help me understand what I'm sponsoring.
The theme park, that I get. But all this talk of super districts and cities of tomorrow, it's a bit complicated.
Well, we think it's simple. You give us control, we give you tourists, jobs, and tax revenue.
Look, you don't have to sell me on those. I'm on your side. But if I'm going to write these bills, eventually someone's going to have to explain it to me so I know what I'm doing.
You don't have to write them, Senator. It's taken care of. The bills are on the way.
Who is writing them?
Just help us secure the votes. We will take care of the rest. Helliwell didn't need Elrod to write the bills because Helliwell wrote them himself. It was a task that was typically reserved for lawmakers, not corporate lawyers. But there was nothing typical about Paul Helliwell or the Disney legislation. It was far from simple. It was long and complex, over 500 pages. But the result was simple. Disney would have complete and total control over its own destiny. Still, writing the bills was one thing. Getting them passed was another. There was plenty of pushback from Florida locals who felt Disney's proposed structure was undemocratic, possibly illegal. And the clock was ticking. The bills were up for vote in April of 1967, just a matter of months after Helliwell spoke with Senator Elrod, which gave Roy Disney precious little time to rally support and push the bills over the line.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. After Walt Disney's passing, Charlie Wadsworth of the Orlando Sentinel wrote, "Walt Disney's death was a terrific blow to his brother. But now Roy's dedication and seeing to it that the Walt Disney World project is all his brother dreamed it would be has given him a new lease on life and new enthusiasm and energies. You've got to be ready to go early and stay long if you want to keep up with Roy Disney these days. But despite Roy's tireless efforts, many locals were suspicious of the Disney legislation. It was legal, but sticky. Walt wanted Disney World to be made up of two cities placed inside a self-governing district, fully controlled by the company. Disney would manage every aspect of the community. Only landowners would have the right to vote or run for office, and Disney would own all the land. Hallowell and the Disney legal team had written the bills, but it was Roy Disney's job to sell them to the Florida legislators. So Roy and Hallowell staged a massive press event and invited important figures from Central Florida business and politics. Walt was always the face of the company, and Roy tended to stay where he was comfortable, behind the scenes. So at this event, Roy again decided to let his brother Walt do the talking and sell the project from beyond the grave. This is the final episode in our four-part series on Walt Disney and the creation of Disney World. End of the line. It's February 2nd, 1967, at the Park West Theater, a 900-seat venue in Winter Park, Florida.
Welcome to Disneyland, USA.
Roy Disney sits on stage with a small group of Disney friends and supporters. But he's not watching the movie on the screen behind him. Instead, he's carefully watching the expressions of the Florida legislators peppered throughout the sold-out house. Roy's invited them here for a special screening of his brother's final movie, the Epcot film.
And now, here is Walt Disney.
Welcome to a little bit of Florida here in California. This is where the early planning is taking place for our so-called Disney World project.
Walt's been dead for less than 2 months, but Roy is keeping the dream of a city of tomorrow alive. And in less than 60 days, these Florida legislators will vote to decide Disney's future. Roy's hoping his brother's enthusiasm will win them over and secure their votes. In the middle of the film, newly elected Florida Governor Claude Kirk, who sits next to Roy, leans over and whispers,
Roy, you nervous?
I am a bit.
Don't be. Did you memorize the speech?
More or less.
You'll do fine, Roy. This is a friendly crowd. Trust me.
At the end of the 25-minute film, Roy watches as Walt leaves the audience with a hopeful message.
Speaking for myself and the entire Disney organization, we're ready to go right now.
As the lights come back on, Kirk leans in close again.
You know, your brother's a tough act to follow.
Yes, he is.
Don't worry, Roy. It's like I said, they're friendly.
Roy takes a deep breath, walks to the podium, and does his best to fill his brother's shoes.
Wasn't that a dream? Doesn't that just stagger you? I'm standing here today because my brother Walt Disney had a dream. Our corporation is dedicated to making Walt's dream a reality, but it cannot be done without the help of you people here in Florida. Before we can begin our work, we need a solid legal foundation.
Roy tries to be careful with his words, because he knows he's making a big ask. After listing off all the details of the solid legal foundation, Roy tries to ease their minds.
Now, I know some of you might be concerned, but this is something that we ask for in fairness for coming to Florida. Now, as for the particulars of our list of demands...
When Roy says demands, the air seems to be sucked out of the room. Governor Kirk's eyes go wide, and for a split second, Roy almost panics. Demands is not the word Roy meant to use. The last thing he wants to do is come off like a bully. So he thinks fast.
Forgive me, gentlemen.
Roy gestures to Governor Kirk. Then he flashes a wide grin reminiscent of his brother Walt.
In the presence of Governor Kirk, I use the word demand softly.
Roy was willing to play the game of Florida politics, to smile for the crowd and play nice with the legislators. But in reality, he was making demands. Prior to the event, he had told one Disney lawyer, if we don't get that legislation, we're not coming to Florida. Publicly, Roy laid on the charm. But privately, he made sure the locals understood. If Florida didn't play ball, Roy was willing to walk and take Disney World with him. To guarantee the bills would pass, Roy needed a skilled insider with strong experience and good relationships in the legislature. So he hired a former Florida politician turned lobbyist. Roy ordered his lobbyist to make the rounds and shore up support for the Disney bills. And the lobbyist knew the game. He knew practically everyone in the Florida legislature. And he knew that to get anything done, Roy would have to win over the man at the top, the president of the Florida State Senate, Verrill Pope. At a meeting in Pope's office, the lobbyist and his team of Disney lawyers were ready to make an impassioned, detailed argument. But Pope was a busy man, and he didn't have time to get bogged down in details. He asked just one question: is this good for Florida? The lobbyist responded, "Yes, sir, I believe it is." And Pope replied, "Well, that's good enough for me." Still, there were plenty of questions Senator Pope might have asked, like how would Disney's two cities interact with the local county governments? Who would get to live there? And would they have the right to vote? Paul Helliwell was the man with the answers. He had been asked these questions at a public hearing not long after the Winter Park screening. He assured the audience there that Disney was not setting up a private kingdom where no one can vote. He claimed Disney had not yet decided who would live in the cities, and he promised the legislators that Disney was in no way trying to circumvent county authority. But Helliwell was not being entirely forthcoming. The whole point of Disney's legislative package was to avoid certain county and state regulations. Helliwell was well practiced in the art of deception, and he wasn't the only one willing to bend the truth. In March of 1967, Disney Counsel Bob Foster, the man who first pitched Walt the idea of a special district, answered more tough questions at a second local hearing. When legislators expressed concerns that the Disney bills would allow the company to avoid county taxes and regulations, Foster pushed back, saying, "Not so. The immunities only apply to property owned by the district and the cities themselves. Most of the property will be privately owned and subject to all county and state regulations." But as Disney historian and author Richard Fogelsong explained, why Foster said the property would be subject to all county and state regulations is mystifying. The legislation clearly gave the district immunity from state and county regulation. Additionally, as Fogelsong also points out, a perpetuity clause in the package made the immunities permanent. Still, despite their reservations, many of the legislators went along with the Disney bills because they felt they had no choice. As one House representative explained, voting against Disney was like voting against motherhood or apple pie. The Disney bills were introduced on April 17, 1967. They quickly moved out of committee and onto the floor, where they passed nearly unanimously. But whether Disney's representatives were honest with the Florida legislature about their intentions is a matter of some debate. In April, Paul Helliwell appeared before a joint meeting of the House and Senate. There was one subject he seemed eager to talk about as he pitched the Disney bills: permanent residence. The legislators believed Disney was building a practical city where citizens would live and work, as that's what Disney representatives had said. But it was arguably a lie. While Helliwell repeatedly told the Florida legislators it was going to be a city with permanent residents, there are indications that from the beginning, Disney knew it would always be for tourists and not an actual city. One indication was a document called the Helliwell Memo, written by Paul Helliwell back in May of 1966. The memo contained a summary of the company's concerns about county regulations in Florida. Walt personally reviewed the language in the Helliwell Memo, and he made various edits and changes to the documents, including crossing out the phrase "permanent resident" and scribbling in its place the word "tourist." Walt's edits to the Helliwell memo may have revealed he envisioned a fantasy community stocked with tourists and not permanent residents. Yet everyone at Disney, Walt included, persisted in creating a different impression. If the Florida legislators had known this, it's possible they would not have allowed the Disney legislation to pass in its final form. But even after conquering the Florida legislature, Roy's work was just beginning. The Walt Disney World Resort was set to open in the fall of 1971, just over 4 years after the Disney bills passed. It was an ambitious goal, but Roy was determined to meet it. Roy put it all on the line for his brother's dream. He publicly committed to spending $100 million on the Disney World theme park, $75 million on Epcot, and another $10 to $15 million every year until the park was complete. By comparison, Disneyland had cost only $17 million to open. All in, Roy anticipated spending $600 million on Disney World, the equivalent of nearly $4 billion today. Disneyland's opening day had been a disaster. Roy never forgot the horror that was Black Sunday, as it was called in the company. So as Roy pushed the company towards Disney World's grand opening, Roy carried with him valuable lessons from the past. He would take a cue from his late brother Walt and strive for perfection to make sure everything at Disney World was, as Walt liked to say, just so.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
It's a hot summer day in 1969 at the Walt Disney World construction site in Orlando. At the Contemporary Hotel on the park grounds, a group of workers lounge near the entrance of the hotel, telling jokes, drinking sodas, and taking a very long break.
Well, you know what the best part about watching color TV is? When the good guy calls the bad guy a yellow belly, you can verify it. You know what the worst part about this job is? What's that? You and your jokes. Come on, this job's a yawn. What else are we supposed to do? I don't know, we could try working. No, thank you. If they want us to get off our rear ends, then they're going to have to pay us what we're worth.
Just then, two men in suits arrive, trying to get by. An older man with dark-rimmed glasses and his younger subordinate. The workers block their path, so the younger man steps forward and tries to be polite.
Excuse me.
You're excused.
Would you mind if we get through?
It's a free country.
What I mean is, you are in our way, sir. Would you gentlemen mind stepping aside so we can pass?
All right, make way, boys.
The group of workers move out of the way as the two men in suits pass by and disappear into the hotel.
Who the hell were they?
Who cares?
Come on, boys, let's find a tree and take a nap.
But while the workers are laughing, the two suits turn deadly serious. The older man turns to the younger one.
This is unacceptable.
I completely agree, sir. I want them fired.
Which ones?
All of them.
The two visitors were a couple of suits, but high-profile ones. The younger man was the genius designer Marv Davis, one of only three men who had a key to Walt Disney's secret Epcot room. The older man was the boss himself, Roy Disney. Roy was frustrated by the lack of progress in the park. On a recent helicopter tour, he looked down at the barren site and complained, "We've got $90 million in this project, and we don't have a single thing above ground." As he toured the project site further, the last thing Roy wanted to see was a group of workers lounging around on the clock. So Roy made sure it never happened again. Charlie Wadsworth of the Orlando Sentinel once said of Roy, "5 minutes after meeting him, you had the feeling you had known this man most of your life." Roy was a likable guy. But like his brother Walt, when it came to Disney's bottom line, he was all business, and his subordinates knew it. One Disney employee said, "Roy was very serious about what he was doing. Whenever he walked into the building, we'd issue a code R over the radio. Roy was on his way to the office." As Roy dealt with a seemingly never-ending stream of strikes, lawsuits, and labor disputes, he kept his calm, even in the face of harsh criticism in the press. Despite the project's high profile and the vast amount of investment, or maybe because of it, some people felt Disney World was a loser. Roy had dealt with this type of gloom and doom before, in the lead-up to Disneyland's opening day. Many critics then had predicted Disneyland wouldn't survive its first year. Walt had proved them wrong, and this time, Roy would do the same. Walt had left Roy a creative roadmap for Disney World, and Roy ordered his team to follow it to the letter. Roy's primary job was to finance the park, and he was highly confident of Disney's position. As he told one reporter, "We hold title to thousands of acres of some of the finest land in the nation. We have a backlog of films Walt made in our vaults that continually appreciate in value. Over the last 15 months, we offered two issues of convertible bonds totaling $90 million. They were sold out to investors." Roy also reminded the reporter that the company expected no problems with cash flow. In addition to earning $20 million a year in revenue, Roy had recently struck a deal with Bank of America and several Florida banks that gave the company a $50 million credit line. So Roy was optimistic about the future. But he was not blind to the many real problems facing the park. Disney World's opening was set for early October 1971. By August of that year, the park was still not ready. Attractions hadn't arrived. Rides weren't finished. The monorail and trams were plagued by technical difficulties. And then in September, a month before opening, contractors walked out on Labor Day, leaving large sections of the park incomplete. Only days before opening, the concrete at Fantasyland hadn't even been poured yet. And it didn't happen until just hours before the first guests arrived. For a time, it looked like history was repeating itself, and that Disney World's opening would be another Black Sunday. But Roy hadn't forgotten the lessons of that fateful day, and this time around, he applied them. Disneyland's disastrous soft opening had taken place on July 17, 1955. Lines were too long, rides broke, even the water fountains hadn't worked. And the official public opening was the very next day, leaving no time to improve before the paying customers arrived. So Roy did one of the most important things a successful business person must do: evaluate past mistakes, learn from them, and correct them. He scheduled the soft opening for October 1st and the grand opening for late October, giving his team ample time to make adjustments and find their footing. Roy also made the grand opening a fitting tribute to his brother, a star-studded affair with merriment, music, and magic. And like Walt had done on Disneyland's opening day, Roy wanted the cameras rolling. The Disney Company produced a musical television special called The Grand Opening of Walt Disney World, starring the famous comedian Bob Hope and a familiar face to fans of Mary Poppins, Academy Award-winning actress Julie Andrews. In the special, Andrews steals the show, singing When You Wish Upon a Star, Zippity-Doo-Dah, and It's a Small World. But mostly, the television special was an extended commercial for the new theme park and resort, with shots of monorails zipping along efficiently, pristine Florida land, and brand new hotels. In one moment in the show, country western singer Glenn Campbell zips across a lake in a motorboat to the Contemporary Hotel.
Now, what I'm trying to do here is kind of clear my head after seeing some of the things that you'll glimpse on the show today. I expected to see miracles take place in all sizes, small, medium, large, and family size, of course. But when I found out that Walt Disney World is twice as big as the island of Manhattan, I just had to stop and think about that a minute.
In the middle of the special, Julie Andrews introduces a stirring tribute for the man who envisioned this epic endeavor.
If I seem a bit eager, it's because a warm and wonderful event is about to take place. From every part of the world, some 140 musicians, representing the major symphony orchestras of their respective cities, have journeyed here to join in a special tribute to Walt Disney and the opening of Walt Disney World. At this moment, these outstanding musicians have assembled here to join their hearts and musicianship in one glowing message for all.
At a ceremony in late October, with his wife and family by his side, Roy read the dedication plaque with Mickey Mouse standing by his side. The plaque reads, "May Walt Disney World bring joy and inspiration and new knowledge to all who come to this happy place, a magic kingdom where the young at heart of all ages can laugh and play and learn together." But it wasn't all joy in those first few days. Attendance at the park started slow. On opening day, they were expecting over 100,000, but only 10,000 came. But as the weeks went by, and as Roy continued to perfect Walt's dream, attendance started to climb and eventually break records. By the end of October, 400,000 guests had attended the park. The company was hoping for 6 million guests in the first year, but over 10 million people walked through the turnstiles. But as Disney World took off, Roy Disney started to decline. At the time of Disney World's opening, Roy's health was failing. He was constantly tired, and his vision had turned cloudy. His eyes were so bad that Roy went to see a doctor who recommended he undergo testing. But like his brother Walt had done, Roy ignored the warning signs and did not seek help. Instead, for the first time since his little brother passed away, Roy took some time to relax. He thought about retirement. He even thought about a vacation. Roy had been working hard his whole life, from the time he was just a boy. Now, with Disney World open and successful, and his promise to his brother fulfilled, Roy was ready to enjoy himself, to be with his family, and to make the most of the little time he had left.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's December 1971 at Roy Disney's office in Burbank. It's a Friday, the end of another long week in what's been a very busy year. But his appointments, calls, and meetings for the week are all done. So Roy takes a moment to relax. He pours himself, as usual, a scotch and water. With the grand opening of Disney World behind him, Roy's schedule has started to ease up. And Roy is grateful. So is his secretary, Madeline Wheeler.
How are you, Madeline?
Oh, just fine, Mr. Disney. Can I get you anything?
No, I'm all right.
Something about Roy seems off, but Madeline can't put her finger on it.
Sir, is something on your mind?
How long have you been working for me?
28 years, Mr. Disney.
28 years?
Yes, sir.
You deserve a medal.
Oh, it went by in a blink.
Yes, it did, didn't it?
Roy's mind wanders for a moment, lost in the memories of the past.
Sir, is there anything I can do for you?
You know, I'm due for a full retirement in a year.
Yes, sir, and you've earned it.
But I was thinking I might stay on another half year. That'd be my 50th year in the picture business. Would you consider staying on?
I was supposed to retire years ago, and so were you.
Well, I suppose you're right.
You're 78 years old, Mr. Disney. You've earned a rest.
Rest? That's no fun, is it?
Madeline chuckles.
What do you say, Madeline? Will you stick with me?
Well, sir, if you're staying,
I'm staying too.
Roy finishes his drink, grabs his briefcase and coat. But before he heads for the door, he turns back to Madeline with a twinkle in his eye.
I may see you at the Christmas parade.
And with that, Roy Disney walks out of his office for the last time. By the winter of 1971, the years of tireless work were catching up to Roy Disney. Roy was supposed to attend the Disneyland Christmas parade with his family. But the morning of the event, he couldn't get out of bed, so he stayed behind. When his family returned from the parade, his wife Edna found Roy unconscious, lying on the floor of his bedroom. They rushed him to St. Joseph's Hospital, the very same place where his brother had passed away. But it was too late. Roy was brain dead. His wife allowed the doctors to remove life support. And on Monday, December 20th, 1971, Roy died of a cerebral hemorrhage just 2 months after Disney World's grand opening. In honor of his passing, the flags at Disneyland and Disney World were lowered to half-mast. But Roy would have been pleased to know that both parks stayed open for business. On December 22nd, 1971, Charlie Wadsworth of the Orlando Sentinel wrote, "It was Roy Disney's guidance and leadership that brought Walt Disney World to its opening. He was completely dedicated to building the dreams of his brother Walt. They say a little of Roy left when Walt died in 1966 of cancer,
but not much could have left. He was the keeper of the flame and had to be the curator of the spirit that Walt Disney created. Walt wanted to build more than just a second theme park. He wanted to build a city of tomorrow. But neither Walt nor his brother Roy would live to see the opening of Epcot Center in October of 1982. Smithsonian Magazine called it the single most expensive private construction project the world had ever seen. But many questioned whether Epcot lived up to Walt's high expectations. In the end, Epcot featured rides and exhibitions that showcased how humans might live in the future. It drew visitors in with a series of international pavilions where guests can imagine they're traveling the globe in a single afternoon. The massive Epcot Sphere, named Spaceship Earth, is now almost as iconic a Disney symbol as Sleeping Beauty's castle. Many of the details Walt Disney obsessed over in the 1960s do exist in Epcot. Monorails, pneumatic tubes, efficient trash disposal. But it is still a theme park, not the city of tomorrow Walt once envisioned. But today, Epcot has one thing going for it that Walt's vision never quite accounted for. It's a moneymaker. In 2018, Epcot helped Disney bring in an average of almost $20 million per day in park admission dollars. But Walt's dream of a city of tomorrow didn't end with Epcot. Many aspects of it were realized just 5 miles away in a little Florida community called Celebration. In the 1990s, the Disney Development Company hired city planners and world-class architects to create a living, breathing, planned community for just a few thousand residents. Celebration had many of the elements Walt originally imagined: squeaky clean streets, state-of-the-art public facilities, plenty of parks and green space, and a walkable urban center integrated within a residential community. Walt never saw it, but he likely would have approved of Celebration's mission to find a better way to live. Disney Development hoped it might become a model for small towns all over America. Walt Disney World's footprint in Central Florida has expanded to include new theme parks like Animal Kingdom, Disney's Hollywood Studios, and more. On the thousands of acres of land that Walt worked so hard to secure in the early days of Project Future, the Disney Company has built giant hotels, campgrounds, restaurants, nightclubs, water parks, and resorts. There is truly no other place like it. And there is no doubt that the company Walt and his brother Roy built is among the largest and most successful in the world. And Walt Disney World is at the heart of it. Disney World is the most visited vacation resort on the planet, with an average annual attendance of over 58 million visitors. According to Forbes, in 2013, Disney's theme parks provided nearly a third of its $45 billion revenue and 20.7% of its $10.7 billion operating profit. And Disney has only grown since. In 2020, Disney's annual revenue surpassed $60 billion U.S. dollars worldwide, even with the effects of the global pandemic. Walt Disney once said, "I hope we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a mouse." But if Mickey Mouse started it, Walt himself carried it forward, and Roy finished the story. A story of bold risks and big rewards, of spies and secrets, of tragedy and triumph, of two brothers with one idea and a grand vision that brought magic to the world. On the next episode of Business Movers, we'll conclude our series on Walt Disney World with an interview with Chad Emerson, author of Project Future, the inside story behind the creation of Disney World. And on the next season of Business Movers, Coca-Cola's greatest mistake, the story of an infamous soft drink that changed the world, but maybe not for the better. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is episode 4 of Disney World for Business Movers. A quick note about our reenactments. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all our dramatizations are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Walt Disney and the Disney World story, we recommend Project Future, the inside story behind the creation of Disney World by Chad Denver Emerson, Married to the Mouse, Walt Disney World and Orlando by Richard E. Fogelsong, and Walt Disney, an American Original by Bob Thomas. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Stephen Walters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.